Tonight on The Download, cognitive scientist and author of What the F, Benjamin Bergen. From The Daily Line, 80 Quig and Heather Sharon. And another installment of The Swap Meet with Greg Flamm. Now, here's your host, a man who is done with thought pieces, Justin Kaufman.
Can't I just like something without having to think about it? I feel like that's not acceptable in 2018. Seriously, like, I'm at my wit's end. Whether it's tweets about Kanye West or Kanye West tweets that are being turned into 6,000-word thought pieces. Or how about if anyone paid attention to the This Is America video from Childish Gambino and the This Is America explained. It's an okay song, and I like it. It's a good video. Is that enough? That's not enough? How dare you? How dare you not explain yourself in 15,000 words on why you liked or didn't like that song? That's where we're at. That's how it feels like. Just do the art. We'll enjoy it. It's The Download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Great show lined up. Coming up, 80 Quig and Heather Sharon. Join us, talk about the race for mayor. Get on the Lightfoot. Lori Lightfoot, the head of the police board, resigned, and it looks like she's jumping in to take on the incumbent Mayor Rahm Emanuel. There's some possibilities of some sparks flying on that one. So you're going to have the head of the police board, which is essentially trying to reform the police department. You have the former police superintendent in Gary McCarthy. You have the former schools chief in Paul Vallis. There's a lot of formers in there. This is going to be I think it's going to get messy. But we'll talk with Heather and AD about that coming up here at 7:30. Tonight, Benjamin Bergen joins us. He was just in town at the Chicago Humanities Festival. And he's a cognitive scientist from the University of California. And he has written a new book called What the F? What Swearing Tells Us About Language, Culture, and Ourselves. That's coming up 8 o'clock. That'll be the big table talking about he really kind of routes the history of swearing. And he looks at how it differs from culture to culture. So we'll have that conversation coming up at 8 o'clock. 9 o'clock tonight, Kami will be here. A great Chicago hip-hop kid who is part of the Save Money crew, which, of course, I don't want to say the birthplace, but it included Chance the Rapper, Vic Mensa, Joey Perp. Lots of great Chicago hip-hop artists have come out of the Save Money Collective. Kami is the next. He will be in studio tonight. We'll talk about his new work. Also tonight, another installment of Writing Out Loud. Beth Finke is back. She's bringing a couple, the Hunts, who have been together for 60 years, married for 60 years. They're both 81 years old. They've been taking best memoir class that she gives us at the through the city. And teaching seniors how to tell their stories, to write their stories. And they come in once a month. We bring people in from her class to tell their story. Tonight, The Hunts, coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. And Swap Meet, Greg Flamm. Last week, I found my Michael Jordan autographed headshot, glossy, and Greg said it was worth over $100. As well as my classic framed, like a plaque, picture of Mike Ditka flipping off the cameras. Seems like every good Chicagoan should have that photo.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Mine was framed in a plaque, and he said, that, too, is probably worth $100. Have I tried to sell them?
Yeah.
No. Have I put them back in the garage where I found them? Yes. No, they're still sitting in our office. I have a feeling that Todd and company here, our management, as we get more and more emails and directives to clean out our offices as we get ready for the big move in the next couple weeks, I continue to bring stuff in to the office, mostly for the swap meet. I'm like, look what I found. Look at this huge grill cover I found. Look at this poster, you guys. I'll just put it in my office. Nobody's using this couch. That's what we're doing at the download office. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back and do the carry out. So stay with us. Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's carry out. All right, here are today's top stories. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was apparently successful in his mini-summit in North Korea. He's bringing back three Americans who were detained in North Korea and have been reported to be in good health. That's great news. No snark. Good job. I don't know what we gave up to get him, but that's great news. Allegations have surfaced that Russian billionaires and American corporations like AT&T have both wired money into the account of Trump lawyer Michael Cohen, the same account that was used to pay out hush money to Stormy Daniels. What does it mean? I don't know. I'm waiting for some partisan rag to tell me one way or the other, right? Or maybe Rudy Giuliani. Everyone says this is completely normal and acceptable. Nothing to see here, folks. Some of the big companies confirm the story, although Cohen denies it. And that's 2018, folks. The story doesn't tell us why they were wiring money in sums of $500,000 to the lawyer of the president of the United States. We don't care. If you don't support the president, you want to know why the president's lawyer is getting huge sums of money to make sure there isn't any funny business going on, right? If you do support the president, don't you want to know why? Just so you can be like, man, it's so awesome how rich my guy is. I don't know. Maybe AT&T, maybe the payment was just money saved from switching from Sprint. Could be. Right? Maybe I'm onto something. Maybe move from Comcast to DirecTV. That's AT&T. Primary results and from around the country suggest that. No, pass. Those are the worst stories, right? When the media tries to read the tea leaves. I don't know why a sitting House, why a sitting representative got beat in the primary. I don't know. I don't live in North Carolina. Maybe he was terrible at his job. Wake me in September. Locally, we're all doing the Lightfoot. It's a new dance craze, and it's the last name of the former head of police board, who's now looks like she's running for mayor. We'll talk about her coming up after the 7:30 news. I love the name, though, right? She could be mayor or possibly a late 70s jazz fusion band. Hey, man, did you hear the new Lightfoot track? We are Lightfoot. Metro is looking to reduce fares to try and bring in new customers, and where are you going to put these customers? Maybe you could just have some ropes dragged behind the trains, and for a cheaper fare, they can just be dragged to Aurora. How about you focus on fixing the trains for the riders you currently have? Just saying. Brainstorming. Spitballing. Yeah. Chicago Tribune's getting after Meghan Markle. She's the woman marrying the redhead prince. I don't pay attention. I think his name's Ron Weasley. Anyway. She went to Northwestern, Meghan Markle did, and the paper boasted of talking to 140 of her sorority sisters to get quotes. 140 sorority sisters. Now I get the new direction of trunk. That's a lot of time. It's taken a minute for me to understand the structure, but I get it now. All sorority sisters, all the time. Sounds good to me. In weather? Of course, severe thunderstorms. Why not, right? Right in time for the commute. Although I'll take hail and down power lines over lava fissures any day. There were reports of tornado sirens going off in Wisconsin. But have you seen these pictures of lava fissures? Am I the only one that's kind of freaked out when I see those pictures? And I'm like, oh yeah, that's in my head what I think of End of Days, the rapture. There it is. Instead, we're like, and in lava news tonight. Now let's check Cheryl Sapp for see what's coming up this weekend. It's going to be sunny. You're like, what? Can't we do more than 2 minutes on lava fissures? Huh. Who knew that the rapture would be so boring? In sports, the Cubs put on a clinic today, finishing off the three-game sweep of the Marlins. Chris Bryant hit his 100th home run today. You know what's awesome about that? It was 3 years ago exactly today that he hit his first. May 9th, 2015. Not a bad couple years, mate. The Cubs are not just a game back of the Cardinals, but still in fourth place. Oh, you NL Central. The Sox, they lost again at home today. They got swept by the Pirates. The Sox continue to find interesting ways to lose. This time they blew a 5-2 lead in the ninth. The good news, Ronaldo Lopez pitched into the eighth inning. That's a good sign for a youngster who has now done that two starts in a row. The bad news? Well, blowing the game. That crazy thing about this season is the Sox are a game up for the worst team in baseball, but yet they are only eight back in the AL Central. A couple of four-game sweeps in there. We're right back in this thing. Come on, Sox. Tonight, Game 7 for the Jets and the Preds to see who takes on the Golden Knights in the Western Conference Final. With the Blackhawks obviously not competing, the only thing I have left to cheer for is a heartbreaking Game 7 overtime loss for the Nashville Predators. Right? Come on, Winnipeg. The other side's the Capitals and the Lightning. NBA action, the only series left to play out, the Sixers and the Celtics. Right now, Celtics have a 3-1 lead, but the other teams are all waiting to get to the Conference Finals, including the one we've been waiting for all year. This is going to be a great series. Golden State and the Houston Rockets. It's my Beyonce. Houston Rockets. Teeing that one up for months. Harden versus Steph Curry. CP3 versus Kevin Durant. No former Bulls on the court. That's when you got a good series, an NBA series, when there isn't like a Pau Gasol hanging around. Also, I thought Cleveland was left for dead on the side of the road. Now they're resting before the Eastern Conference Final? Come on. You got to work on your storylines, NBA. It was like a week ago. They're like, what's wrong with LeBron? Now they're waiting. And they will be in the NBA Finals. What else? We got any Bulls news? No? How about the Bears? No? Chicago Fire? Yes? They're playing the Montreal Impact tonight. There you go. Go Fire. Also, the Rickets want to bring another soccer team to Chicago, mostly so they can build another stadium, you know, for the licorice rope industry. And finally tonight, a new study says that every Illinois resident owes the state $11,000 to fix our pension crisis. That's what we're on the hook for, $11,000 each. Think about it. That is one shiny, expensive can. Get it? Kicking the can down the road? No? Yeah, look better on paper. You take my payment in installments? Or maybe through Michael Jordan autographs? It's the carryout for May 9, 2018. Stop taking 50 napkins, will you? You only need 3, maybe 5. Okay, 10 tops. All right, coming up, the race for mayor, 80 Quig, Heather Sharon. Ben Bergen joins us at the big table. Talk about his new book about the history of swearing. It's coming up on the download tonight, 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, buddy?
Oh, man, I really wanted to hold class outside today.
I know, right?
God, it was great.
Then the rain came through.
Yeah, well.
Washed away all the chalk art from the weekend.
That's right. Big flowers.
312's got a great point from something I was saying earlier. Their problem with the This Is America explained pieces that we're seeing everywhere is that it makes us look like the dumbest generation. Older generations didn't have the Mona Lisa explained. Or the starry-eyed, Starry Night explained. That's so true. Could you imagine if there was Twitter, if there was The Atlantic during the Mona Lisa? Mm-hmm. What this painting is trying to say, Mona Lisa explained in 5 parts. It's a 15,000 word piece.
Yeah, that's a painting.
It's a painting.
Looks good. It's nice. Looks good. Well done.
I'm just mad that Childish Gambino is stealing my moves. That's totally my dance moves. Those are my dance moves. I've been doing those moves for years. Everyone knows me knows that. Anyway. It's Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, I would give all the buzz about the mayoral race another week. The oxygen will be sucked out by the, of course, the budget fight that's going to start up in Springfield for the spring session. But right now, all eyes, all election eyes are on who is getting in the ring when it comes to the upcoming municipal election and the race for mayor of Chicago. In studio, as they are every Wednesday night, 80 Quig on the line, Heather Sharon. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us. Happy to be here.
All right, so let's get into this. Both of you are covering City Hall for the Daily Line, which covers everything for City Hall, county, state politics. Am I right in that assessment, AD, that it does feel like, even though we're in the middle of a general election for governor of the state of Illinois, that all eyes and ears are on what's happening with the mayor's race?
Yes, although I should say I've been seeing tons and tons of those JB commercials that look like they're an Oppo research film, where they're like, JB, Twitter or Facebook? And he's like, Twitter. So it's not like he's super duper letting up on TV. But yes, this week, all eyes on the latest candidates getting in. Tomorrow, we're expecting police board president who just resigned, Lori Lightfoot, to jump in.
Lori Lightfoot. Okay, Heather, what should we know about Lori Lightfoot?
Well, it's interesting because if she's elected, she will make history in two ways. She'll be the first African-American woman to be elected mayor, and she'd be the first openly gay mayor. And I think that will not be a small part of what she'll talk about tomorrow. She gave interviews to the Sun-Times and the Tribune where she talked about how, she's married, she has a 10-year-old daughter, and that she thinks she can talk to how Chicago and the African-American community has changed even in the last, 5 years, let alone 10 years.
And we've been talking on the program about who would step up to really speak for the African-American community in the municipal election. Obviously, there's a lot there when it comes to what happened with the Laquan McDonald shooting and how that was handled by the mayor. He's been on a nonstop two-year Band-Aid tour to repair relations, and there really hasn't anyone to step up. Is Lori Lightfoot the candidate that steps up?
Well, it's interesting because she is almost uniquely positioned to criticize Mayor Emanuel on these sort of issues, because not only was she president of the police board, but the mayor handpicked her to lead the advisory task force that he formed in the wake of the release of the Laquan McDonald video. And she has been critical of the mayor's leadership on a number of points, probably most vehemently when he was trying to avoid having to go to federal court and give a federal judge oversight of the reform effort.
Right, yeah. And more recently over community control of the police department. She worked pretty closely with that Grassroots Alliance for Police Accountability to do kind of a bottom-up, ground-up community oversight of the police. And the mayor came in on the same day it was introduced, had his ally introduce two other ordinances, which she said would incur the wrath of Black Chicago if he tried to slip in these kind of weaker measures. She straddled interesting worlds in her career. She was a federal prosecutor. She worked at the old Chicago Police Department Office of Professional Standards. So she's prosecuted police, and she's also defended police, kind of doing this public corporate law, but also like grassroots accountability kind of stuff. It's very interesting.
And the abrupt resignation, obviously everyone in the political sphere believes that to be, of course, that she's going to run for mayor, but it also signals her disappointment with the process and what has happened with police oversight and reform since what's happened with Laquan McDonald.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think that she has a lot of history on those issues, so she'll be able to talk to those issues. And I think I said this when I was on the show the last time and we were talking about Gary McCarthy's campaign, is that this is the conversation that Rahm Emanuel does not want to have on every single day of the campaign. And it's becoming more and more clear that, there will certainly be other issues, but this is going to be, right up at the top because, in some ways, Gary McCarthy is going to criticize the mayor from the right. He's not being tough enough on criminals, and that he's, sort of kowtowing to the left with these reform efforts, while Lightfoot will say, yeah, you're not going far enough, Mr. Mayor, which is, I think, a difficult spot for the mayor to be in.
And obviously, the other name that we didn't get a chance to break down was Paul Vallis getting into the ring, bringing up another weakness with the mayor when it comes to the state of Chicago public schools. Of course, Vallis famously ran Chicago public schools after the takeover in 1995 under Mayor Daley, then Mayor Daley. I mean, that is another name that if anything, represents an area that Emanuel hasn't had much success with when it comes to schools, education.
Right. Well, he would argue that the schools are better than ever, right, AD?
Yeah. Every week we're getting a new press release about record-setting graduation rates, certain CPS high schools being honored by national publications. He loves pointing out the successes of the schools. And the interesting thing about Vallis is he doesn't have necessarily the support of school advocates like CTU. CTU actually really hates Vallis. They say he led to the corporatization of schools. He led to a proliferation of charter schools in Chicago. So it's interesting that we haven't yet seen a candidate enter the race that can kind of speak to grassroots support for school reform.
Let me do this. Let's take a quick break so we stay on time. But I want to come back to that because we had Paul Vallis on the Cochran Show 2 or 3 days ago at the beginning or end of last week. And it was interesting that he said that he would get the support of the majority of Chicago teachers, if not this Chicago Teachers Union, but he would get support of majority of Chicago teachers and the teacher union head management that was there when he was running public schools in Chicago. We'll talk about that and whether that's true and if that means anything and whether or not Paul Vallis has the kind of name recognition that could make him a formidable opponent for the mayor coming up in the municipal in February. Heather Sharone and AD Quigg join us every Wednesday. They're here right now. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back, continue the conversation. Stay with us. Rob. Download 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman here. AD Quigg and Heather Sharone joining us from the Daily Line. It covers all things Chicago County state politics at dailyline.net. Congrats to Heather Sharone, who was named the managing editor just last week. Heather, congratulations.
Thank you. It's very exciting.
Yeah, we should do a whole segment about your future plans.
Yes.
We'll wait on that. Well, wait. Well, right now, we'll continue the mayor conversation. But yeah,
I was going to say only my mom would continue listening.
Well, when you talk about Paul Vallis and Paul Vallis and what he means to Chicago, he does have name recognition. Obviously, he was a big politician who came in and administrator to the CPS takeover in 1995. Is that overstating it that Chicagoans may have favorable memories of Paul Vallis and his time here in Chicago, Heather?
You know, I think that's an interesting question because, to put this in context, I am no longer, sadly, a spring chicken, and I was a CPS student when Vallis took over the district under Mayor Daley. So, it was a long time ago. And let's, think a little bit about what he's done since then. He moved to New Orleans. He oversaw the restoration of the New Orleans School District after Hurricane Katrina. He ran for lieutenant governor, and he led Chicago State University for a while. So he's bounced around quite a bit. The Chicago Teachers Union do not want to see him as mayor of Chicago. And I think I've said before that I've been sort of holding my breath to see who they back. And, there's no way that it's going to be Vallis. And I think it's going to be hard for teachers to get behind Vallis with their union saying, this guy wants to privatize Chicago.
And it was a different union back when he was there in 1995. He said he had a good relationship with the union. He thinks a majority of teachers would vote for him. But you're right. I mean, this is a different union. And Karen Lewis and company at CTU have obviously led the charge in what they want from schools in the 21st century.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very different political environment. A few years back, the legislature changed the law so that teachers had to get an 85% yes vote before they could go on strike. Many people thought that that meant there would never be another teacher strike in Chicago. That obviously was not accurate. that I think tells you how unified the Chicago Teachers Union has been. And again, Chuy Garcia is now on his way to Congress, but I'm repeating myself a little bit, but they helped make him a household name in Chicago, and now he's in Congress and can play a little bit of the kingmaker in terms of who's going to be the next mayor of Chicago, potentially.
When you look at the way that the demographics break down in the city of Chicago, when you look at who supported the mayor last time around when he first was elected, you're really looking at residents that live in downtown Chicago and what we call up the gut, meaning all the north side neighborhoods, Wrigleyville, Lakeview, even all the way up to Rogers Park. And the question is, as you look at the list of candidates that are lining up to take him on, I think McCarthy will do well with police officers, rank and file, not necessarily where those police officers live. You know, same with African-American communities. They're not living up the gut in that Lakeview. So which one of these candidates has the best shot to take a bite out of the support that the mayor has seen in the last couple elections?
Yeah, what's interesting, we did an analysis last week, I believe, looking at where Rahm Emanuel's, he's raised millions of dollars just in the past six months or so alone. I think he's raised $4 million, which is, you know, a ton of money, way more than anybody else has. But we took a look at where he was getting that money. 65% was coming from outside of Chicago. A good chunk was coming from the suburbs and the rest of Illinois. About a quarter was coming from D.C. and New York, which I found fascinating.
Yeah.
And a lot were huge transfers from, you know, familiar construction labor groups who gave to him big time last time. And huge ones were from basically D.C. union groups and lobbying firms, and also Michael Sachs, who gave him $500,000. So I will be very interested to see if Lori Lightfoot, who was a corporate attorney at Mayor Brown, captures some of that downtown corporate law money and also attracts, because of her status as a black gay woman, if she attracts national attention and national donations for that.
Mm. Heather, what do you think of that question? Who do you think has the best shot to take a bite out of the support of Mayor Emanuel?
Well, you know, what's interesting is that Mayor Emanuel's pitch last time was, I am tough enough to run the city, right? That's essentially what it was. And then there we have the infamous sweater ad where Rahm said, look, I know I can be a little bit abrasive. I'm sorry about that. I'll do my best. So the question is, with somebody like Lori Lightfoot, somebody like Gary McCarthy, you know, is he going to be able to make that same they can't handle the city argument based on their experience and what they've done before? And will some of those people who have fat checkbooks think that it's just no longer worth putting up with Rahm's abrasiveness and say, maybe it's time for something new? So, you know, that's going to be the really big question, is that, you know, can somebody get over that hump of actually sort of convincing enough people with enough money that, hey, they could actually do the job of Chicago mayor?
Quickly, as we wrap, I mean, is this it? Is this the end of the candidates lining up? The 27 candidates or whatever we have at this point? I know it's less, but is this it?
I wouldn't put any money on that.
Yeah, we have so much time. Petitions don't start going on until Labor Day. We are all waiting to see what Bridget Gaynor does. I think that's
Cook County Commissioner, right?
Bridget Gaynor and also Rod Joy.
Uh-huh. Rod Joy, who ran for Lieutenant Governor with Chris Kennedy. And Bridget Gaynor is that kind of Lakeview Cook County Commissioner who could, as I just said, take a bite out of that corridor vote that has always gone for the Mayor Emanuel. Yep. Heather Sharone, 80 Quig in studio, as they are every Wednesday night. They are with The Daily Line. Heather, the new managing editor, congratulations. TheDailyLine.net. We'll see you guys next week.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, tonight, let's talk language, specifically bad language. We don't get a chance to discuss profanity on the radio very often, but tonight we can because of the outstanding work of author Benjamin Bergen and his new book, What the F? What Swearing Reveals About Our Language, Our Brains, and Ourselves. In the book, Bergen looks at all kind of vulgar language and how certain swear words play out in different cultures, how definitions of these words have morphed, and how humans have used these words to both attack and cope throughout time. Benjamin Bergen is a professor of cognitive science at the University of California, San Diego, and he was just in town to speak to Chicago Humanities Festival, and he is my guest tonight at the big table. Benjamin, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
This is my pleasure.
This book is so good. So good. I just want to say something. I've been looking forward to this. So you say that this is a love letter to profanity. Where does this come from?
Well, you know, I'm just a guy. In addition to being a professor and stuff, I'm just a person who uses language in all of the normal ways. And I think, like a lot of people who really love language and love its expressive potential and love to be creative with it, I enjoy all of its different manifestations, and that includes profanity. And in addition, as someone who's also a relatively new father, I've been confronted with lots of questions about whether profanity is exactly the right thing to use in all circumstances. What are the limits on it? What are my personal limits? What does the science say about whether we should be using it around kids and what it does to their brains as they're growing up? And so to me, this is just a fascinating area of research. And I started to dig into it a little bit as someone who works on language and the brain and discovered that there is stuff there. We don't really talk about it in public, like you said, but there's a science there.
It's amazing to me, too. And a lot of the premise for the book is how there have been many studies about language and profanity always kind of gets cast to the side. Almost that this is a slice of language that we don't necessarily need to research. But as you say, it's very important. It might be vulgar. It may be hurtful. It may be disgusting, but it is important. Vulgar language is important to the language.
Would you study biology without sexual reproduction? Like, that's kind of the thing. Like, we don't talk about sex that much in formal context like this, but you really wouldn't understand much about biology if you didn't focus on that. And I think it's kind of the same thing with language. There's all kinds of stuff that profanity reveals about the brain, about how we develop language, how it changes over time, that you just wouldn't get if you stuck to the clean stuff.
And it's so interesting because it does follow a lot of scientific research. For instance, and we'll get into this throughout the hour, I love that profanity follows patterns throughout history, that you will see certain words pop up and then disappear and then come back, and the meaning changes. But it does follow almost a scientific pattern when you think about how it plays a role in language.
Yeah, that's right. The words that are profane in one generation may completely disappear in the next generation. There are certain trends, like you said, there are certain places that they tend to come from, certain aspects of our human experiences that we find so taboo that the words that describe those experiences, those become profanity. And that's true across languages and across cultures and across time.
Which part of this was the most exciting for you? Because we're going to get into it. But was it the idea of researching certain words, the language part of it, just the consonants and the sounds that we've seen even from the English and the German languages and how they've split? Or was it how the brain interacts and uses and how it responds to this kind of language? For you as a cognitive scientist, what was the most exciting part of this research?
To me, it's the brain science. You know, we know that there are people who have trouble using language because they have strokes or traumatic brain injury. And swearing seems to work differently in those people from the rest of language. We didn't really know why for a very long time, and we're starting to discover exactly what the brain is doing when you swear and how that's different from what it's doing for us right now, producing rational, intentional language and understanding it.
Let's talk about that, because there's a great part in the book about I think it was a 19th century priest who had figured out from the language that was used accidentally, essentially how swearing works around the brain and aphasia. Aphasia is the terminology. Tell this story. This is a great story about how you learned a little bit about how swearing kind of plays out in the brain.
Right. So there's a French neuroscientist by the name of Jacques Lorda, like you said, in the 19th century in Montpellier, France. And he studied language and studied the brain, and then he had a stroke. And he lost the ability to speak. He had aphasia. He eventually recovered, but he dedicated the rest of his career to studying people who were just like him. And one of the most important case studies that I discovered, although 150 years late, I guess, was that of a parish priest. He's this man of God who suffered a stroke, lost all of language with the exception of two words, the word je, which means I, and then a second word, which Lorda wrote was a word which begins with F and which our dictionaries have never deemed suitable to print. And it's the French F word.
Those are the two words.
The two words, I and this F word, and he's a priest. And this is now relatively well known among aphasiologists that when you have damage to your brain that knocks off those parts of the brain that are especially human and abstract and do complex reasoning and complex language that we don't share with other species, and you lose language, still you preserve swearing. And we're starting to discover why. And it's precisely that spontaneous swearing, that emotional expression of your immediate experience, you know, when you stub your toe or when someone, for example, maybe a spectator at a baseball game catches what would potentially be a game-changing drive or something like that.
Right.
When you express your emotions immediately through language, that uses a different system of the brain.
Yeah, it's almost like the ums and the ahs, the likes and the weird words we use to fill time. Swear words fall into those categories.
Yeah, it's a part of the brain that's very, very old that we share not just with other primates, but other other vertebrates in general, mice have it. You know, when your dog vocalizes to express emotions, when she yelps or barks or snarls, she's using this other system of the brain, this emotion-driven vocalization system that we seem to have too. We've got two ways to talk. We've got the new complex combinatorial rational part, and then we've got this really immediate emotional expressive part, and they can be separately affected by brain trauma.
And this thought that we may have an internal editor, this concept that somewhere in the human brain there is an editor at the end of the factory line before the sentence comes out that scans to make sure that you're not using the wrong words. And sometimes that goes away when you have an emotional response or you stub your toe because you use this word, you throw it out without thinking. But that there is this way that we communicate and the way that we use language, that the brain has a whole system in how we talk.
That's right. So we know that you are unconsciously monitoring what's about to come out of your mouth. And we know that because of profanity. So if you were to believe what Sigmund Freud said, let's say, you would believe that when people make speech errors, when they screw up their words, that it's mostly because they're thinking about something that they don't want to be talking about and it comes out, right? That's a Freudian slip. But actually, when you look at the statistics on it, the speech errors that people make are actually disproportionately not Freudian. They're disproportionately not taboo. People don't slip up and say bad words. They slip up and say non-bad words. And that, with a bunch of neuroscience and a bunch of sort of psychological research, has shown us that, in fact, you've got a monitor in there. That monitor is judging, that thing that you're about to say, that's going to be a bad word, better put on the brakes. And that's stopping people from making as many Freudian slips as you would expect.
It blows my mind. And, you know, I think about it as my profession. I am a talk show host. I'm on the air and I broadcast for a living. I have to make a conscious decision because if you knew me at home, you know, like I just got off a ship, you know, I'm swearing like a sailor. But I don't bring it here. There's a focus to say that I'm not allowed to do that on air. And it's interesting to think about how my brain works to essentially have an internal editor to make sure that I don't slip into and say a word that I'm not supposed to say.
You know, when we stick people in brain scanners, we can actually see how the brain is doing it. And it's doing it in a very similar way to how you inhibit other sorts of things that you might otherwise naturally do. So let's say you're at a stoplight and the light turns green and you're about to go. You're about to release the brakes, step on the gas, and then all of a sudden you hear a siren coming from the side. Okay, now you got to stop. Right? You've got to stop what you would normally be doing. Well, the brain systems that do that stopping, that inhibit what you would normally, your normal behavior, same systems that you're using when you inhibit yourself from naturally, spontaneously producing a word that you think, oh, maybe in this context, maybe not the right setting.
Best conversation ever. Benjamin Bergen's in studio. His book is called What the F? What Swearing Reveals About Our Language, Our Brains, and Ourselves. Just in town for the Chicago Humanities Festival. He's a professor of cognitive science at the University of California, San Diego. Take a quick break. We come back. We'll talk about how we choose the words that we put into that emotional bucket as swear words. The history of these swear words and where they come from is as fascinating as anything. Benjamin Bergen in studio tonight at the Big Table. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, the author of the book, What the F? What Swearing Reveals About Our Language, Our Brains, and Ourselves, is in studio. Benjamin Bergen, who is a professor of cognitive science at the University of California, San Diego. It's just in town for the Chicago Humanities Festival. There's so much in this book, and we talked a lot about the brain part of the book, but then just gets into the history of where swear words come from, why we use the words we use. You really do a great job of going back into history to find the origins of some of these words. And it's interesting because there's a lot of categories that are in the book, but we'll take four to talk about in the second segment. There's slurs. Slurs, ethnic slurs, other slurs that we know, huge part of swearing. Bodily fluids, of course, sexuality, and religion. Religion is one that, let's start there, because you think of the words holy. Even Jesus, in a way, has changed in the way of what it means. But there is a whole collection of swear words that come out of religion. Talk about this.
Well, this is probably the original source of what we think of as profanity. Profanity itself, the word profanity comes from profanus, which means outside of the temple. And in many languages, especially languages associated with strong religious cultures, these are the words that are strongest, most offensive, most powerful. In English, it's not true across the board anymore. in the deep history of English, say before the 18th century, those were absolutely the strongest words in the language. We don't really use them much anymore. They're the ones that you mentioned. But we don't say things like gadzooks,
right.
which comes from God's hooks, which is, you know, a Jesus reference. We don't use that anymore. But in other languages, certainly they do. In Quebecois, for example, just across the border, the strongest words are religious terms from Catholic tradition. So the words for chalice, the words for other liturgical concepts are among the strongest words in Italian, in Spanish. Their strongest profanities are religious, and it's not surprising given the long history and tradition of the Catholic Church in those languages. But yes, it spreads and changes over time. So in the course of history of American English, yes, it was religious terminology for a while, and then language revolving around sex, mostly, starting in maybe the 19th century, became verboten, and people were, with these Victorian attitudes, didn't want to talk about sex in public, and even the F word rose to prominence as a vulgar term in the 19th century, really wasn't profane before that.
I mean, you pointed out, and rightfully so, that anything that is considered taboo in our society, that's usually where the vulgarities or the profanity will play, meaning if it's a taboo word, it's usually because it's a taboo subject.
Yeah, that's right. We wall off rooms inside of our houses for sexual activities and for bathroom activities, and so it's not surprising that those activities, which are themselves taboo, would transfer the taboos from the world to the word that describes those things.
It's so interesting. And the religion part, you're right. Words like gadzooks, it's something that you would think you'd only find in comic books for kids. I would never think that that would be an origin swear word, that would be something that if uttered in mixed company, people would be like, oh, I can't believe you said that. It's just there's so many of those words that have been left behind that have lost their meaning that used to be super offensive.
I hate to tell you, give you some bad news, but, you know, you're maybe around my age. I'm in my early 40s. So it turns out that even the words that we think are really bad are on their way out.
Really?
Yeah. So when you do surveys with, you know, millennials and younger Americans, you find that the words that, say, were in George Carlin's list of the 7 words you can't say on television, not even in the top 10. So the strongest words, according to younger Americans, are, in fact, slurs. They're really offended by words that denigrate by ethnicity, sex, sexual orientation, that sort of thing, ability. And the F word is number 13 on the list.
That's hard to believe at 42 years old, 43. You know, I feel like there would never be any replacement for the F word. That would be in the top 3. That's like to hear that it's 13th among younger generations is startling.
But this is the treadmill that these words are on. They start off as being mundane, everyday words. That same word, the F word, during Shakespeare's time would have been just a sort of run-of-the-mill term. And it, again, rose to prominence as profanity with the Victorian attitudes that arose in the 19th century. And it's starting to dribble back down the charts.
And being just thinking of intergenerational, when you get to a certain point, you hear words being used. I think of the word gay. Is a good example in our generation where you heard it being referenced, that you hear it in old Shakespeare, where the word gay, it meant something different, meant happy, right, than what we knew. The word dick is another one where there was a whole generation of people named, that was their nickname, Dick Nixon, Dick Van Dyke. And today, anyone who would be named Richard or Rich would never shorten their name to Dick.
Right. And I think that's true. So we've got in the book, I did a little survey. I looked at the Social Security Administration's naming database to actually track that there are no children who are given the name Dick since like 1970 as their given name in the U.S. But there appears to be a little bit of not backlash, but a little bit of reverberation there, because that term, you know, it was more offensive 20 years ago than it is now.
Right.
It's fallen down the charts as well. And so younger Americans don't really think
they don't see it as a derogatory in any form.
It's a little bit derogatory, but they don't.
But not, top 10. Right?
Not to the point that it's so offensive that they wouldn't use it as a nickname. And so there are actually some younger people, high school kids, for example, who think that it's a perfectly reasonable thing to call themselves. It's as if the word had impact at a moment in time. It affected naming practices because, well, you know, it's this word for genitalia and you don't want to call your baby boy genitalia. And then as that meaning started to disappear, so did the biases against using
it as... And that is the power of this book and the power of this discussion is just this idea of meaning and weight and how certain words that we may know mean something else to different generations and they follow this pattern. It's fascinating to me to think about some of the words that you and I grew up with that we could never say that have different meanings now. They don't actually mean the same things that they meant to other people.
Yeah. So among the most offensive words to younger Americans is a word that starts with R. They call it the R word. It's used for people who have mental disabilities.
Interesting, yeah.
And growing up on the playground, that just meant idiot. You're just a dummy.
Yeah, thrown about with no issue whatsoever.
And boy, that's one of the worst things that you could call someone in my freshman seminars, for example.
Interesting. In studio tonight, Benjamin Bergen. He's the author of What the F, What Swearing Reveals About Our Language, Our Brains, and Ourselves. He is a professor of cognitive science at the University of California, San Diego, was just in town for the Chicago Humanities Festival. We'll take a break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. We'll continue the conversation tonight at Big Table with Benjamin Bergen. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio tonight, we're talking with Benjamin Bergen. He's the author of What the F, What Swearing Reveals About Our Language, Our Brains, and Ourselves. He's a professor of cognitive science at the University of California, San Diego. Was just in town at the Chicago Humanities Festival. We're really talking about language, but we're talking about profanity. You mentioned at the beginning about kids. This is the third part of this conversation, really about the emotional baggage or the weight of what profanity plays in our world, stress, other things. We've talked about slurs. Slurs, you know, has an impact on a younger mind and frankly, everybody. But there is, when we start talking about how vulgar language affects kids, it shifts a little bit.
So there's this pervasive belief that any profanity around kids is going to harm them. You know, what things that you hear, or maybe they're going to have a stunted vocabulary, or maybe they're going to become more aggressive if they hear aggressive language around them, or maybe they just won't figure out the right context to use those words, and that's going to look bad in public when they use it in school.
Absolutely.
And there's really not any evidence for any of those things. So when you look at it, when you look at the end point of that sort of childhood of learning, when the 18-year-olds show up in my lab, you don't find that the more frequent swearers or the better swearers are less intelligent or less proficient with language or less able to control their emotions. In fact, to the extent that there's any correlation, it's the reverse. People who are really proficient with profanity tend to be more proficient with language in general, and that results in higher...
That is the reverse. A lot of people believe that you are a lazy intellect, or you have a lazy intellect if you're using swear words.
My best interpretation of it is that language is language, and that people who are creative and proficient with language find it in all of its different manifestations. So that stuff isn't true. But certainly what is true is that verbal abuse is harmful. Kids suffer from depression, anxiety, they have trouble in school when there are people, including classmates, but also caregivers, who say things to them that make them believe that they're worthless or that they are going to be physically harmed. And that doesn't have to be profanity. It can include profanity.
Right.
And slurs certainly do that work. There's been a couple of studies showing that children in junior high schools who are most addressed using slurs, the studies that I've seen are always homophobic slurs, mm-hmm. are most likely to show changes in their ability to cope with school and anxiety and depression and so on.
It leads to stress. The brain reacts, the emotion of being a slur being used against you. There's evidence to show that stress goes up, that there is an emotional response to it.
For sure. So that makes them kind of a special kind of profanity. As for all the rest of the stuff, so, you know, let's say, you know, you're watching a White Sox game, something good happens or something bad happens, and you get really excited and your kid's in the room and you let loose with whatever it is that you let loose with. I know this is Chicago.
Plenty,
there's probably a lot of letting loose.
Right.
A lot of reason to let loose. So is that going to harm your kid? There's no evidence whatsoever that that's going to cause any harm. And there's also no evidence that kids fail to learn the contexts. I mean, you were saying just now, you have two different linguistic lives, right? You've got what you do at home, and you've got what you do at work, where you have to be very careful about language. Kids learn that. I have a four-year-old. 2 years ago, he knew this is a place that you use the potty. This is a place that you don't use the potty. And language is just like that. They're always learning about shaping their behaviors to context. And by 2, by 3, by 4 years old, they're very able to figure that out. maybe a kid is going to experiment a little bit in school, figure out, oh, I see, teacher doesn't like it when I use this word in that context, and they'll learn. They'll figure it out.
You know, we talked about a little bit earlier about the emotional response when it comes to swear words when you stub your toe or other issues, and that's what I want to ask about, because I've seen swear words take on, and I think about sports a lot with this. I'll see like a basketball player makes a huge play, slam dunk, and he's slow motion coming back down the court, and it is a just a barrage of swear words in a positive way, in the way that he's very excited and motivated to win the game for his team, and everyone's cheering. But it is interesting that swear words mean something to all sorts of different situations.
Yeah. Really, the undercurrent is that they're about emotion. And it's not necessarily negative emotions. I mean, that's what we usually tar them with, this negative aura. Like, oh, well, when you're aggressive or when you're angry, when you're frustrated or in pain, you swear. And that's true. You do. But there's lots of work on swearing out of jubilation, swearing as part of sexual arousal. There are all sorts of positive dimensions of swearing as well. I think of it as any sort of powerful tool, right? It's got positive uses, it's got negative uses, it's really what you do with it.
Through time, and we've seen, as you mentioned, basically patterns and history and meanings have changed, but there are some swear words where the weight doesn't change, at least in modern history, and I think of the N-word as a great example of the torment that's associated to that word and the damage that it's done. We talked about the emotional stress of that. It's probably the one word in the English language that is not played with lightly.
Right.
Do you see that with other swear words? There have been times in the history of language, and I think globally, not just here in America with the English language, where words have moved out of the realm of all swear words and moved to the top of the heap?
Well, look, there's a very clear reason why that word is as powerful as it is, and it has nothing to do with language. It has everything to do with the history behind the use of that word.
Right.
So, and in general, that's what you see, that words take on particular meaning and unique power when there is a history of antagonism behind them. And so you see that during times of war, slurs for, say, Vietnamese people or Korean people, super powerful. Or slurs for German people during the Second World War or the First World War. When the circumstances create antagonism, the language that's associated with those circumstances sort of it indexes it. It points to it. Like this is a really bad thing that people have done or that people believe, and it's very hard to disentangle the words from that.
I feel like we could talk about this all night because we haven't gotten to the actual sounds of these words. The CK, the hard K, is very interesting. The passage about the F word and whether or not, you know, some will say it's an acronym at one point, and you chart it all the way back, and you find out it can't be an acronym because the words that the acronym stand for weren't around when it would have come, because you've seen how it plays out in German and Swedish, all these different languages. Is great. And also, another part of this is just the different swear words in the different cultures, because we're all, as human beings, obviously, we have different ways that we express ourselves through language, but even before language, there are hand signals, there are facial expressions, there are ways that we were able to emotionally transcend or communicate the same concept of what a swear word is supposed to do through our hands, through our face. So this is something that is not just about how we speak and the words that come out of our mouths, but who we are as humans.
How we express emotions. Yeah, there are undercurrents that run throughout our species. And, you know, maybe the most interesting question that you're kind of getting at is, where does this come from? Like, what's the impulse to swear? Like, why is it that we have profanity at all? Why do we have a middle finger? Not why do we have the finger, but why do we have the gesture that uses the middle finger? And it's possible that this is part of the story of how language came about in our species, right? It's possible that our earliest vocalizations as humans were expressions of emotion, just like what your dog does, you know, get off my lawn kind of expressions,
or
I want to express my affection towards you. And that these expressions, these vocalizations use the pathway that profanity still uses. Maybe profanity, not in its current form, not these specific words, but this kind of use of language is older than the nouns and verbs and complex sentences that we have ultimately over time evolved to be able to express and understand.
That's fascinating. Benjamin Bergen is the author of What the F? What Swearing Reveals About Our Language, Our Brains, Ourselves. He, of course, is a professor of cognitive science at the University of California, San Diego, and he was just in town for the Chicago Humanities Festival, and we didn't even swear.
Yeah,
we made it through the whole
segment.
We did it. We did it. Benjamin, thanks so much for being my guest tonight at the Big Table. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Justin.
Coming up, we are going to have another one of our monthly installments of Writing Out Loud. Author and journalist Beth Finke's in. She's bringing in the Hunts, a couple that's been married for 60 years. If you're not familiar with this segment, we called it something else for a while. I forgot what it is. Writing Out Loud is the best name. It's named after her memoir. Beth is blind, and she teaches a memoir writing class for seniors at the city. And because of being visually impaired, she has the seniors, they have to stand up and stand, they don't tell her. That was funny. I think it was Audrey, whoever was in the last time, said that she always thought they were standing up, Beth, but she can't see. They sometimes sit down. The difference. But you stand up in class and you read your work, as opposed to having a writing teacher who takes it home and reads it and brings back notes. No, you're part of the presentation in this memoir writing class is you have to perform it. And it helps the writers to see the experience of how people are reacting to the words, how they feel about the words as they come out of their mouth. And it is helping seniors write their story, put it down, and understand it. So to add on that, Beth brings in select students once a month, and I interview them, talk about their story. Tonight, a couple, the Hunts, 60 years together. They're both 81 years old. They'll be my guests coming up at 9 o'clock. Be fun. Also, a little bit later, from the Save Money Collective, hip-hop artist Kami, K-A-M-I, Southside kid who is with the Save Money Collective, famous collective at this point. A group of kids who got together because they all loved hip-hop and culture, hip-hop culture, and little kids named Chancellor Bennett, and I don't know if Vic Mensa's, maybe that's his real name, I don't know, but Joey Perp, Tokyo, all the great Chicago, there's more. We've had plenty. There's 10 or 15 of these kids. They met in school. And they have become the go-to hip-hop collective, not just in this city, but around the country. And Kami, one of the original members, it's his turn. Got a new album coming out. He's playing the Vans tour, which is coming up on Memorial Day. He's got show after show that lined up. He's the hip-hop artist to watch, 2018, that kind of stuff. So Kami coming up a little bit later in the show. Sit down with us. And then a swap meet, 312-981-7200. Your collectibles, your memorabilia, your junk. If it's worth anything, Greg will tell you. If it's the best brag of the night, I'll give you a pizza. You have to beat some of the great brags I've had. The folded over glossy of Michael Jordan that I got from my dad's friend who used to work in one of these buildings downtown. He got it signed. That's the story I got. He showed up. I think he was a security guard, or he worked at one of the buildings down here, and either Jordan lived in it or, you know, went in to get his taxes. I don't know what he was doing. And one day when I was 10 or 12, whatever, I got this given to me. And I think it's funny because it's not signed to me. It's just Michael Jordan, which is fine. And at the time, I was like, I think our neighbor forgot my name. You know, or you know, the other thing is it didn't go down the way he made it seem, like he was buddies with Michael Jordan. And Michael's like, let me sign this for you. Or he got it from somewhere else, but, you know, what do I care? But as Greg told me last week, it's worth more that it didn't say Dear Justin. And it's an action glossy, and you don't see those. And he looked it up, and it was over $100. It was going for more than $100 on eBay. And then, you know what I do? I put my signature next to it. 200. You make an exclusive.
Did you bring anything else? Because you have a box back there.
I got
there.
A box of stuff. I got to go through there. I got this great book. I got to figure out a segment out of this. It's called Chicago Confidential. My dad found it in a thrift store. And it's a first run strange tour book in 1952, something like that. And it's essentially a guide to Chicago for tourists. But it's not like, you know, go to the architecture cruise. I don't think that was happening at the time. It was more like, where do you want to gamble underground? Where do you want to pick up a call girl? What to watch out for when they try to pickpocket your wallet? How much certain services from the call girl cost? It's the weirdest book. And every time I read it, I'm like, I'm learning new things. What we were looking at it the other day. It had some funny thing that was like a Lucy Loose, or I forgot what it was. It wasn't the sandwich, whatever it was, but it was something that was nasty. But it was all in, like, it was just kind of like a hustler's guide to Chicago. You want to play craps? We'll show you where the cops will never bust you. I have that, which is awesome. I have an old WGN Cubs bumper sticker from the 80s, but I didn't bring that in. I opened up my box of memorabilia that my mom and dad gave me that was all my stuff from school. It's so musty. Number one, I was like, oh, God, I started sneezing and runny nose. And in it, my wife was so perplexed because it was all given to me by my mom. She's cleaning out stuff, and she's like, hey, you might like this stuff. It's some of your stuff from, you know, I thought it was going to be posters from high school, yearbooks, things like that. It's like my baby shoes and my birth certificate and like a little onesie that I had when I'm kidding. My mom, or my wife was like, why wouldn't your mom keep this? Why is she giving it to you? It seems like the wrong kind of stuff to give to me. Like it was like, oh, good. I got this finally. I can put this in storage. It's like stuff that you would hang on to if you were a parent.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, so it's a lot of like, there was little shoes and a lot of really sloppy drawings and cards when I was 5 and 6 years old. And I'm like, no, unacceptable. Makes me recognize how gifted my son is. He is.
You see his drawings. Yeah, he is at the same age.
Yeah, it's like, mine. Oh, I'm like, oh, I am not talented. There's nothing talented about this. But the other thing that's in there that's so strange is all my report cards.
Yeah, I think I have all my report cards.
I don't want my report cards. And it's funny because my son just gets so giddy at reading about the teacher's comments on my C minuses from 7th grade. Justin has an attitude problem. You know, it's a lot of that. Justin doesn't pay attention, and he has developed a bad attitude towards language arts. You know, like that kind of stuff. And so here's my 10-year-old going, because we drill it down, you know, no bad attitudes in school, that kind of stuff. And I'm like, hey, Mom, keep that to yourself.
Yeah.
I don't need that.
Keep that hush, hush. We had grades for effort and achievement.
Oh.
And I remember, you know, getting like an A in math, but then like a C. I'm like, what do you mean a C?
Double.
For effort.
You got to even it out, man.
But I was like, how do you know I'm not trying? I got an A.
Yeah, right. You had a lazy, it was a lazy A. It's a lazy A, Pete. I am giving you a long every day. It's the download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's time for another installment of our new monthly segment called Writing Out Loud. Author and journalist Beth Finke teaches a memoir writing class to seniors through the city. She's been doing it for years. The goal is to get her students comfortable in writing down their life experience, their story. Beth Finke is the author of several books, including Writing Out Loud, What a Blind Teacher Learned from Leading a Memoir Class for Seniors. Last month, she brought us Audrey Mitchell. We learned a lot about Audrey's life. Tonight, Beth is back with a pair of students, Anne and Bruce Hunt. The Hunts have been taking Beth's class for years, and they have been together for 60 years. They're both 81 years old, and they are in studio tonight. Everybody, hello. Thanks
Hi.
For being here.
Good to be here.
Beth, great to see you.
Great to be seen.
So, okay, so let's get right into it. I mean, just to refresh the memories of our listeners, this is a segment we do because you teach a class. You just got back into it again this week, or this is, you just started a new class.
Yep.
Talk about this class.
Boy, the class started about 15 years ago. I had one class at the Cultural Center. It began because I wrote a memoir myself called Long Time No See, and Joyce Gallagher, who still is the head of the Department on Aging, asked me if I'd be willing to lead a memoir writing class. So I gave it a try, and it worked, and it grew.
Yeah, right.
So now I lead 5 classes a week, Some for the city, some for the Village Chicago. Those meet in Lincoln Park. Some at the Admiral, which is assisted living. Nah, it's called something nicer than that. You know, whatever you say. Yeah, a place for older people live. And then one in Printer's Row. We just started up last week. I had a lot of time off to promote Writing Out Loud, the book, and other things, take computer classes and stuff like that. So I had a lot of time to come up with the prompts. This is the first time I've come up with the prompts ahead of time.
The prompts are the most important,
Yes.
What are some of them to look for? I don't want to give away to your students in the room.
No, you can't, actually, because I wrote to every single student I had today. I spent time this afternoon, and I thought, on the ride over in the cab, I thought, I'm going to give the prompt. So now I'll know, when I go to class tomorrow, who listened to the show and who didn't.
There you go.
So the prompt.
What are the prompts?
In honor of Mother's Day, the prompt is, I want all the writers in my classes to write about a trait they share with their mothers.
That's good. That's
so
good.
So whether it could be something you hate about yourself because you can't believe you do this thing, that you, or something that you're very proud of.
Yeah, that you admire, right.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. Well, of course, Writing Out Loud, What a Blind Teacher Learned from Leading a Memoir Class for Seniors. Great Mother's Day present as well. So,
yes.
All right, let's meet some of your students. Who have you brought to us tonight, Beth?
Who have I brought? I have brought Bruce and Ann Hunt. They have both been in the class for, each of them have been at least 10 years. Mm-hmm. Until last week, the two of them were in separate classes. They both live near Lincoln Park. They spent a lot of time in Lincoln Park, so they're involved in that organization. Mm-hmm. But if I remember right, I don't want to take over your job, Justin, but I'm going to ask someone.
No, please.
And I think, Anne, you didn't want to be in the class with Bruce. Isn't that right? I mean, didn't you want to be separate, sort of?
I don't know that it was actually something that we really decided one way or another. I think part of it was that originally, I think we had different kinds of schedules. That was part of it.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. So Bruce started first.
I started first, and I was in the Thursday group. And at the when we started, there were 15 women and me.
Yes.
I was the first guy to join that. Well, I wasn't the first guy, but I was the only one at that time. I think somebody had been come and gone.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a critical decision that we be in separate groups. But it was kind of, it was by mutual
agreement. Do you think being a couple for 60 years, that it's easier to learn to tell your story when you're apart, meaning where you don't have each other filling in the sentences or being able to edit each other in the stories that you want to tell? Is it almost easier in the fact that you weren't in the same class together?
It may well have been. I the way it worked was that we would each create our story separately, she on Monday and me on Thursday, and at lunchtime we'd read to each other. Mm-hmm. So that's the point at which it got to be a shared thing.
Well, I think among other things is that we both have written as part of our professions, and I think it's not unusual for us to share what we've written, even if it's, you know, it may be more that I've written about something that's interesting to me or that I know more about, but I'm looking for some feedback.
Do you, when you're both writers and you're both in the same class, are, but even in the same, you know, maybe not the same day, but the same class, do you think of each other as the audience? I mean, when you're writing these stories, are you thinking, I wonder what Bruce is going to think about this, or Bruce vice versa?
Yeah. That's a really good question,
it is.
I think. What's your answer?
Well, yes, I think so, because I think very often when we're writing for something other than the writing class, and we often do that, I mean, we've written for neighborhood newspapers and for college update kinds of articles and that kind of thing. So I've always seen, I think Bruce's first of all, he's very smart, and he's a good writer himself, so I respect his feedback to me. We have different kinds of interests. He's not particularly interested in, you know, my thing seems to be cooking primarily, has always been from my career, but and his has been business and students and all kinds of cerebral
pursuits. Yeah, sure.
Things of the mind.
Games, whatever. Right. But we will often talk about it, but I don't unless there's something specifically saying, you know, I'm confused about this, or I think this could be more clear. Mm. I very much respect his feedback. I do say that.
Yeah. Well, let's do this. Let's take our break so we have more time on the back end to get to know you guys. Bruce and Ann Hunter here. They're students in Beth Finke's memoir writing class, memoir class for seniors. We'll take our break here. We'll come back and we'll continue our conversation here on Writing Out Loud. So stay with us. I am giving you it's the Download 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman here in studio. Beth Finke. She teaches the memoir class for seniors for the city. She also is the author of Writing Out Loud, What a Blind Teacher Learned from Leading a Memoir Class for Seniors. Beth comes in once a month with some of her students to tell their stories here on the Download. Good to see you, Beth.
Thank you.
All right. So let's talk about, so we talked a little bit about setting up why you guys take the class and the fun stuff about the class. But let's get to know Ann and Bruce Hunt, who are in studio. They've been together for 60 years, both 81 years old. They've been taking the class for about 10 years. How'd you guys meet?
We met in college. And Ann had a roommate that I was infatuated with and not making very good time with. And so I used to set up coaching sessions with Ann, and she would coach me on how I could present myself more effectively to her roommate. And I found, frankly, that I liked the coaching sessions much more than the date.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
What that was part of her story, part of her angle.
Yeah. Well, those were the good old days when the girls had to be in at 8 o'clock at night. There was it was Worcester, Ohio, and there wasn't any place you could go for any kind of privacy on that campus. And so one of the things that happened was that after our particular sophomore year, there was this rash of people who had formed these relationships who began to kind of look to, you know, where's this going to go? How are we going to find ways of being together?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And by the time we got to be seniors in college, we were taking over the old units that had been built for veterans who were coming back to school, and for $40 a month rent, which was a lot less than we were paying for our rooms in the dormitories.
That's where you went.
Mind you, in that day, we got married before we moved into the barracks.
Yes.
You had to be married.
You had to be married.
Yes.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Yes.
What brought you to Chicago? What was it that took you back up here?
Well, I was coming to do grad school here, and so that brought us to Lincoln Park, and we got cautioned about, you know, do you really want to live right in the city? And we said, yeah, we do. And that was 1959, and we've been in the city, except for a time we went to the country, but we've been in the city ever since.
To think about what, you know, a neighborhood like Lincoln Park since 1959 has seen a lot of change, but it's also been at the epicenter of a lot of things. I mean, just think 10 years later in the late 60s, we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of protests and what have you. I mean, you guys have been in a position where you've seen Chicago change.
We were there. Mm. We were there during the protests. We were there for all of it. But among other things, you know, we were there when it was a mixed community. And that's where I really developed my interest in ethnic food.
And that's what you ended up doing for your career. You opened a cooking school.
Right.
How did that come about? What was it about food and cooking that draw you in?
Well, I think, among other things, it's something that...
Well, tell a story about Dolores Messini.
Yeah, I think it's something that you can share if you come from very different backgrounds.
Right.
And I could tell you a quick story, which was that one day we lived on Bissell Street, which runs along the elevated tracks, and there was the fire engine was out there, and everybody was coming out of their houses and like, what's going on? Well, here was this little naked child running around in the middle of the street. Nobody knew whose he was. And so we were all trying to figure out what to do about this. And we got talking to each other, and this one woman, Mrs. Messini, and she was a big Italian woman, very, very imposing. And finally she said, I got to get in there and get my tomato gravy going because my husband works up on a high, very high, what do you call it?
Building.
Crane.
Yeah.
Crane. Yeah. On a crane. Right. And when he gets home, he wants his dinner. He wants his dinner. So I said, just to be nice, I said, you know, sometime you have to give me your recipe for spaghetti sauce because I never made very good spaghetti sauce. Make a long story short, the next day, she rang the doorbell. Here she is with two shopping bags. She said, I've come to show you how to make the spaghetti sauce. Well, I think the real story was she wanted to see what my house looked like.
Yeah. Of course.
You know, who are you? You're not like the rest of us right. on this block. And so that was the start of...
But you also said she was really in the kitchen. She was really graceful and telling her story about... You know, where the foods come from and what part of was right. for a part of her tradition.
Well, and she'd grown
and
up
really
in the
impressed
city.
You.
Right. It did impress me. And I told a girlfriend of mine about it, and she said, you know, what a wonderful way to get to know your neighbors and to just, you know, we were both interested in food. And so that turned into a project where we decided to start a cooking school, which we did. And we met... it was what was formerly a sort of a kitchen and
test kitchen, wasn't it?
Pardon?
In the gas company?
And the gas company had this area right across the street from the Art Institute where they had stoves and refrigerators and everything, and then they would have demonstrations. But Zelda knew somebody, my friend Zelda knew someone who was involved, who worked for them, and they said they would be delighted to give us the space for mm-hmm. nothing. They were looking for ways that they could reach out to the community and become yeah. more known for that. So we started a cooking school, and that
became your career.
Yeah. That became both of our careers.
One of the things that I thought was really important about that was that was their way of introducing the city in terms of its strengths. I mean, these were mostly women who were cooking in local neighborhoods and had a great reputation there, and bringing suburban women, not all suburban, but many of them suburban women, coming in to learn about the city in terms of what was strong about it, not what was pathological.
You both, we have about 3 minutes here,
yeah.
and... You both are taking this class to learn how to write your own story. Your story obviously continues on, and yeah. we're in this segment, we just get slivers of it. And just recently, you were diagnosed with Alzheimer's, early stage right. Alzheimer's, mm-hmm. and it makes you think about the immediacy to tell your story, to make sure that these stories are on paper, that people know it, because. They are up in your head, and at a certain point with this terrible disease and affliction, that's what's robbed, the idea of being able to recall those things, to be able to communicate mm-hmm. your right. life story. So is there a rush to tell your story?
I wouldn't say rush. I mean, at this point, I've been diagnosed almost 2 years now, and I've been sort of surprised that it hasn't been worse, and I have continued to be monitored along the way, so I'm aware of what's going on. Now, part of it is perhaps medications have changed, perhaps that's a little bit better. I continue to swim a couple times a week as a way of just staying in shape, and I've also participated in a Alzheimer's group where we do various kinds of crafty activities.
Okay. And writing, too, Beth. I mean, that's...
Yeah. And writing.
And the stories that you wrote, say, 6 years ago, do you ever read them again? And does that help you remember? Or are you not there yet?
I can't say that I've made a point of going back to read them again, although I must say that in preparation for today, I have a giant... You know, a binder that has stories in it. And just looking at those stories, I thought to myself, I am so grateful that I have these stories that I can, you know, if I can't read them, someone can read them to me, and they can be read among my children, can read them. And I feel this is a legacy that is one of the best things that I have to give, yeah. that I have to leave.
No, you took a time off from writing, and you right. come back to it. And I've heard right. you say one of the reasons you wanted to is to get some of these stories down.
Right.
So in terms of the urgency, I want to push there. A little yeah. bit on that, because I well, think there is some urgency
yes,
in doing
and,
that.
Yes, but I also, I mean, I you know, I think that Beth has really supported us in looking for the stories and valuing our stories. So it you know it may not seem like anything all that important, but if yeah. it's been something important in terms of something my family will remember about me or about the times we've had together for celebrations or whatever it may be, I think those stories are invaluable.
Well, I look forward to reading the memoir when completed. Ann and Bruce Hunt are here together for 60 years, both 81 years old. They are students of Beth Finke's. Beth teaches the class to seniors. She's also the author of Writing Out Loud, What a Blind Teacher Learned from Leading a Memoir Class for Seniors. She joins us every month for our segment, Writing Out Loud. It was a pleasure to meet you, Ann. And Bruce, thanks for coming in. And sure. Beth, always a pleasure. Yes. Good to have you.
All mine. Thanks.
Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. Well, my next guest is Chicago hip-hop artist who's part of the famed Save Money Collective. His latest EP is called From Me to You, Chicago. It's Kami.
Just like the movies. She said connect.
Name is Kene Ekwenife, is a Southside.
Right.
I said it right?
Said
See?
It right. Yeah.
Already off to a good start.
Yep.
Southside Chicago native who's been a part of the Save Money Collective for years now. That collective, of course, is a group of some of the biggest names in Chicago hip hop, from Vic Mensa to Joey Purp to Chance the Rapper. Kami's the next big name to come out of this crew, although fans of Chicago hip hop would argue he's already burst through. People know him very well. Red Eye called him one of the acts to watch in 2017. In fact, Magazine gave him the same recognition this year. Mm-hmm. But with all the rappers mentioned above, Kami brings a more adventurous, experimental vibe to his music. The new EP is called From Me to You, and Chicago hip hop artist Kami in studio with me tonight. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah, nice to meet you too, man.
Is that fair to say that you bring that you're the more adventurous, experimental one in Save Money?
I think everybody has their own adventure that they go on, and mine just might have a little bit more turns and twists, but still an adventure all the same.
It's probably not a surprise to you, but just give us your feelings about how Save Money went from a collection of young friends who were doing great stuff to now synonymous with Chicago hip-hop, if not known nationwide, worldwide. Mm-hmm. Does it surprise you that you've had so much success that people know Save Money at the collective like they do?
I mean, it's just a blessing. Like, you know, we've all been friends since forever. It acts like we're getting old now. But,
what are you, 25 years old?
Yeah. But it's just dope, though, like, you know, that we all got to attack, like, the same career path and find success in it. Some of our friends are the biggest people in the world. Chance is one of the biggest people alive. So it's just pretty cool that everybody can kind of just exist in that pocket. Yeah. You know?
You went to Whitney Young High School.
Mm-hmm.
When you started out with Save Money, and you know, like you said, it's been a couple of years, but you're still 25 years old.
Yeah.
When you guys developed a collective, was the goal to be hip-hop artists, to make this a career, or was it just fun and creative and hanging out with friends?
The goal was realistically to save money. Like, realistically, like, it kind of just spurned from, like, people saving up, I don't know, lunch money, or just, you know what I'm saying, trying to buy clothes, just finding ways to save money, whether we were regretfully, like, stealing out of downtown stores, stealing jeans, or whatever we were doing as kids. It all just came from the whole concept of trying to just save up money so you could do the things that you actually want to do.
You know? How important was the music at the time for you guys? Was it more just an ethos of you guys hanging out and saving money, or was music on the mind?
Yeah, music was, I think that everybody started realizing it. We would freestyle all the time. First, it's like funny, just a fun lunchtime thing to do, or just like whenever we were chilling or whatever. But I think it just evolved into a passion for everybody. Once you kind of explore all these options, like, do I want to go to school to be a financial advisor? Hell no. So, like, it's like, I'd rather freestyle all day for a living. And, you know, I think that's what it turns
into.
Good
if you can get it, right?
Yeah. Oh, no offense to the financial
advisors.
No,
I don't think any... Most financial advisors want to be rappers, so okay.
Basically. So, yeah, it just turned into what it did. And I think it is a genuine passion for everybody, because I don't think anybody's really geared to do things that they don't want to do. Even if they want to, like, see the rewards of something that they might admire, they're not going to consistently do it for as long as we've done it. And as passionately as all of my friends have done it, if we didn't really want to do it. So it's just like a God-given, this is what you're supposed to do.
You know, there's something to be made of the idea that a lot of the artists that are in Save Money came from certain areas, went to schools in different areas, and were able to cross-collaborate, meaning that the people who lived in on the north side or the west side or south side were able to meet up because of the way the school system is set up. Do you see that as a positive, the fact that you were able to grow up on the south side, go to Whitney Young, which is right in the near west side in the
right.
West Loop, and be able to meet people that weren't necessarily your neighbors?
Definitely. That's why it's kind of sad with all the stuff going on with the CPS schools getting closed down and all of that type of stuff, because I think that through CPS, one good thing that always comes from it is just the people that you meet, even if it's not necessarily at your school. Schools interact. There's a community of CPS students. Everybody knows who everybody is, whether it's like through social media. I think at the time it was like Facebook. We were just all meeting up through whatever parties or just like gatherings, you know what I'm saying, just social events. And those are the times where you form your lifelong friendships. It's like, I think it was a super blessing being able to be from the South Side, where there's not that many options on the South Side, and be able to go to a magnet school like Whitney Young.
How does it help you musically? How does it help you in your career as somebody who has been able to put out as much as you've put out? You put out a slew of stuff. How has it helped you to musically to be involved in that cross-cultural, cross-collaborative environment?
It's just being aware. There was a lack of interaction with certain groups of people that I had going into high school. I had never interacted with Latino people or white people. Just coming from the South Side, that just wasn't in the daily agenda of going to elementary school on the South Side. So it's just a different perspective, and you become more aware. Just culturally different things that you could talk about and topics that you could approach that everybody can, because you gather your own information,
right.
Everybody can relate to.
Kami's in studio. Kami is a Chicago hip-hop artist. His EP is called From Me to You. It's out. We'll talk more about the music coming up here on The Download. We'll take a quick break. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio, Chicago hip-hop artist Kami. His latest EP is called From Me to You. He's part of the Save Money Collective. Some of the biggest names, not just in Chicago hip-hop, but now worldwide, when you talk about Vic Mensa and Joey Purp and Chance the Rapper, of course.
There we go.
You have been creating music. This EP is a long time coming, but talk about how it's different than your other music.
Well, this EP, it dropped during, like, Valentine's Day. I had went to L.A., but I ended up getting in the studio for the 3 days that I was there. Like, that would be from, like, the 10th to the 13th. And I had made 2 songs in that span of time. And I recently just got a girlfriend. So I was just like, I want to just drop something for Valentine's Day. I haven't had a girlfriend in a long time. So I was just like, this would be a cool
personal,
way.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a personal thing.
A great gift.
It's, I always try to do stuff with music that's actually happening in my life. So it was a good way to channel some energy.
Making us all look bad. All the guys around the world. I show up with my little, oh, yeah, no, I stopped off, and I got this candy bar. It's real nice.
No, but the funny thing is she was mad at me because I didn't get her flowers and a chocolate. I'm like, damn, I made you a whole EP. But whatever. Basically, I was just like, I wanted to do something special for Valentine's Day, and I think that just came out of me.
And you're 25 years old now, mm-hmm. and I think about, you know, like I said, Save Money's been around since high school years, and your music, how do you see it evolving? How do you see as Kami, I mean, you've changed names, you were going as Kami Dechuku
while,
now it's just Kami. Mm-hmm. How do you see it changing? I mean, as you now get to the point where you have so many more doors open because of your the bandmates or collective mates that mm-hmm. have had success, how do you see the music that you're going to produce as a young adult?
Life comes one day at a time, and the things that change you happen sometime in between all of that. So I've just always been good at adapting. From what I'm seeing now, is that's what I just want to continue to do, is just adapt to whatever situation, whether it's I have a new girlfriend or I want to go to Miami for a week and go soak in the strip club culture. Like, I don't know. Like, I don't know what I want to do. But
just if you get a new girlfriend or soak in the strip club culture, you
know, I don't know,
one, man.
I don't know. It's like I'm saying, like, I guess those two things right after each other aren't really a good look. But I'm saying, like, anything that is happening in my life, I think that's how my music is going to evolve. Like, I just have to always pull from life.
Lyrically, you will always adjust because, of course, you're writing about what you know and what you live. Mm-hmm. Musically, when you talk about the beats that are produced and how you approach your music, the patience, there's a lot of slower stuff, you know, that you've done, especially on this EP. How does that play out? Lyrically, you will, you know, be a sign of the times. Whatever's going on in your life, you'll sing or rap about. But when it comes to the music, how do you evolve that way when you're starting to think about how the music sounds?
I feel like there's always been connection and like music in people's souls. I think that's just in you. I think you just gravitate towards things and you have to have the ability to kind of curate putting a certain group of lyrics onto a certain
right.
composition of music. I try to work with maybe 1 or 2 people when I'm making a project. Realistically, like the album we dropped in 2017, I worked on it completely with one producer, Knox Fortune. And
yeah,
it,
been in here,
you know what I'm saying? It really helps to capture the energy or a specific direction. I'm big on going completely one way. So I just like to find people that I get along with and who also have a certain sound or direction that they want to go in, and then figure it out from there.
Yeah, life is about choices, right?
And exactly.
I've heard that plenty of times. But music is about choices as well. I mean, you have to commit to what you're doing. When you get into a studio and you got new music and new ideas, how much are you collaborative? How much of it is, I have a vision, this is what I want to try to accomplish, can you help me get there? Or how much of it is, hey, let's put it all on the table and see what sticks?
See, that's the beauty of working with 1 or 2 people, because it's easier to collaborate. I think that when there's too many cooks in the kitchen thing, I think once that's the case, that's when you start making things that are kind of synthetic versus where it's like you're valuing the 1 or 2 people you're working with's opinion because you guys are working so closely. So it's a respect thing. It's like, oh, I want to hear what you have to say versus there being 10 people in the room and somebody that you damn near don't even know who is an attachment of somebody else is like...
Play with knobs, right?
And sometimes that's cool. Sometimes that's cool in post.
Right,
you get your ideas out, for me personally, when I'm trying to form ideas, it's really hard for me to try to form everybody's idea at the same time. I like to form my idea and then edit it because it's like if I'm the person working on this stuff, I want to get my idea.
It's your direction, right?
Selfishly, too.
You know, when you have people who are calling you the next biggest thin name in hip-hop, and whether it's Red Eye or Fact Magazine or others, and you're coming out of Save Money with so much attention from Chance's success and Vic Mensa and even the others. I haven't mentioned Tokyo. And
of course.
But as they continue to have success and they continue, is it more pressure on you to say, okay, it's my turn. It's my turn. I got a new album and it's going to drop and here it is. Or is it freeing in the fact that, you know, they've paved the way. They open up doors and relationships that you didn't have before.
It's a little bit of both, I think. I think it's in the sense of pressure, I have to kind of live up to what they've already done. Just from the perspective of everybody else watching, is going to be like, I can't do anything that's weak, because they're going to look at it like, oh, well, he's not as good. He's just the tag along, right, or something like that. And the other way, it's super freeing because it's these relationships are there and ready to be built for me. So it's like, yeah, this is Kami affiliated with Vic and Chance. And I'm like, that's great. These are my personal friends. You know what I'm saying? Why would I stop myself from having those connections to help me? That would be stupid. It's just business 101. Right. But at the same time, it's just, once again, like, it does help. It definitely helps, because it's like, if I go in the right direction, then it's like, we're ready to accept you. We already saw it.
Well, I mean, the old saying is they'll open the door, but you got to walk through it.
Right? Exactly.
Right. What's next for you?
Me and Smoko Ono, he's a producer.
Great producer name, by the way.
Smoko Ono. It's so crazy to me. Like, yeah, me and Smoke are working on a whole project, a joint project. I'm super excited for it because it's a little bit more traditional. It's a little bit more slight. Like, it's a little bit more what people think that they want. So I'm excited because it's turning out really good.
All right.
I generally never really do features. It's good features on here. So I'm super excited to just go in that direction now.
Kami's my guest. The latest EP is From Me to You, but he's got new music that's on the way. Of course, one of the members of the famed Save Money Collective here in Chicago. Chicago hip-hop artist Kami, thanks so much for coming in and talking.
Nah, thank you, man. For real. Thank you.
Here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure. Like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman
and Greg Flam.
Wednesday night.
There we are. Greg Flam, at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. It's time for the swap meet. If you got your collectibles, your memorabilia, your junk next to you, ready to go, you can find out what it's worth. I saw earlier we had a joke in the carryout about the Tribune had a piece today about how our pension debt responsibility, if you broke it down citizen by citizen,
right, what was it?
11,000.
Yeah.
So now the swap meet is more relevant than ever.
Right.
Because you're going to need to pay up that $11,000 at some point to be a citizen. So why not do that through that unwrapped toy?
Right. You're a good comic book away from that.
Right. You're one good comic book. Or like me, you got the autograph of Michael Jordan, and you just can't do any better than that.
Right.
So why even play, guys? Best Brag tonight gets a pizza. 312-981-7200. So I would assume we are in the thick of it. Garage sale season has begun. Am I right?
It's a good time. Last week was good.
Yeah?
Brought one of the items that I found.
So is it blooming? Is it like flowers? Or I mean, are we just seeing?
Last week was really good. This week, looking ahead to the weekend, not as many sales this week. But, you know, there could be some pop-up, you know, sales that happen right away.
You get your 10-speed out and just kind of go block to block?
Yeah, you know me. My Pee-wee Herman bike.
don't say Schwinn bike, because whenever we say Schwinn bike, someone calls in, it will be then Schwinn a run night on Schwinn, so right, it'll be Schwinn night. All right, what'd you find this week?
All right, so this week, I'll get to this in a minute, but I found this Mattel Vertibird, and it was basically one of the first like RC like toys to be made.
And this is the helicopter. It was a helicopter most of the time. But what's cool is they made it in like five different versions. And the holy grail of this is the Battlestar Galactica version. Whoa. I have not even seen that like on eBay sold or anything. That's like the white whale. This one happens to be the common ear police, but this is still untested. Like, I can't get it to work. I tried. But even in this condition in the box, it's got a lot of the accessories, about 100, 125. So,
even when it doesn't work, just to have the box and everything. That's cool. It's very 70s.
It is. It's 1971, 73.
My favorite part about the box, if you're watching on the webcast, the favorite part about the box is the little fingers on the right side that are adjusting the joystick. They're like two little hands.
Well, what's funny is like this could be my picture right here for me from the 70s. Nice, that could be me right there.
Nice yellow turtleneck.
Yeah, yellow turtleneck. You know, my hair was straight back then. So
yellow turtleneck.
Yeah.
Always works.
And here's something. This is funny. I was going through my storage locker, and I picked this like 2 years ago before the movie. It's Black Panther.
Black Panther.
1978, issue number 9. And I got it for probably 50 cents a couple years ago. And I'm not a comic book guy. And Justin, you know this.
Yeah, I know that.
And so I was going through my locker. I came across this. I priced it. They're going for $235 because the movie came out and exploded. You know,
there you go.
So this one, obviously, I'd have to get it graded, but I'm thinking in this condition, maybe $50 to $75.
You're well on your way.
But for 50 cents, not bad.
You're well on your way to paying your obligation to the state.
Yep. And then we have this Black Mystery Box, which is old, not real old, but WGN swag. So if you want to get into that, we can do that.
Oh, so okay. So
and
this
I'm giving this to Pete and yourself.
Okay, so this is WGN swag.
It's a black mystery box.
A black nondescript box.
Yep.
A small box. What would you say? That's
It's about the size of a watch box.
Yeah.
You know?
It looks like, and so we don't know what's in it.
Nope.
So Pete,
they don't.
We have to figure it out tonight what's in there without seeing it. And maybe we can play like a game of 20 questions with.
It weighs more than a watch, put it that way.
Weighs more than a watch.
Yeah.
I'll go first. Is it a ceramic doll of the duck? That used to be the Wally Phillips.
Ray Rainer, or no?
You know, and it would do the, you know what I'm saying? Like the commercial used to be the cartoon and it would go on its side and you'd hear Wally Phillips' name. No?
Nope.
You know what? This game.
I know.
It's rigged.
Let's just open it up and go for it.
No, it's too early.
It's too early.
Early. Keep it there.
All
We're going to figure out what it is. 312-981-7200. Let's go ahead and go to Jeff and then we'll start it off. Jeff, what do you got? What do you want to brag about?
I got a signed picture of Coach Ditka in his Bears uniform walking past the cameraman giving a finger.
Yeah, this is classic. This is a classic.
It is.
And I have the same one. Mine is framed in plaque form.
Yep. It's a photo mounted on a wood plaque.
Someone mounted it on a wood plaque.
Yeah, and they made it
in
lots
of
different forms. I've had the poster. Justin has the plaque. It's very common. It's still sought after today. You'll have no problem getting rid of that. I mean, if it was just an 8x10 photo, probably not. But if you know, like I had a larger poster, probably like 24x16 or something.
And those go for money.
Yeah, they
do.
They're like $80 for the poster.
$80, Jeff. You can get 80. That's signed too.
But if it's just an 8x10, maybe $30.
Did you sign it? Did he sign it for you?
He signed it.
Did he laugh or is he so used to it? He's like, this picture.
That's exactly what he did. And I saw him at the Benny's out here in Lake Zurich.
Okay.
When he was promoting his wine.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I not only got that signed, but I got
a bottle of wine signed?
Signed wine bottle, too.
Nice. He's like, I'll sign a picture, but I got to sign a wine, too.
You got to
buy
the bottle
of wine.
Right. So did he put your name on the photo?
No.
Okay.
No,
if it's just his name, that's good.
He's a pro.
There you go.
He gave you a gift there.
Yeah, that it was.
All right. Well, that's good. So you might get put it up on eBay. You might get $8,500 out of that.
If it's more than 8x10. I don't know how big it was.
Yeah.
Okay.
Otherwise, keep it and mount it and put it in your front door so everyone knows where you're from.
Right. There you go.
All right. Thanks, Jeff.
Cool. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
All right. That is a classic. 312-981-7200. We got some texts coming in. We got Laura on the line. We'll get to them right after the break. It's Swap Meet with Greg Flam. Stay with us. Swap Meet, 312-981-7200. Greg Flam is here at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. Got some people on the line. We're ready to evaluate your collectibles, your memorabilia, all the good stuff that you've got. Let's start with Laura. Laura, what do you want to brag about, Laura?
Hi, I have an ivory bangle bracelet. Mm-hmm. It has a little bit of carving on it. I think it's from the 1920s.
Wow.
Wow.
Talk about a needle in a haystack. What is he supposed to do with that, though? You know, like, that's going to be a hard one. I don't mean to be curt, but that's, I don't know. What do you even look up? Do you look up ivory bracelets?
Just looking up what she said, basically. There's obviously a big variety from $15 to $1,000. So if somehow you could have someone send or text a picture next week, maybe, we can get into that.
There you go.
But, yeah, there's
it's an ankle bracelet?
No.
A bangle.
A bangle bracelet.
Oh, bangle.
Wear on your wrist.
Right. Yeah, got it. Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds lovely.
Yeah, it does. It's just...
So you can't find anything.
Yeah, I can't find...
It's hard. It's not specific enough.
Yeah, it's not specific.
Sorry. Thanks, Laura.
Sorry.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
I want to help her out. I was hoping...
I know.
She got... Oh, yeah, we found the one you're talking about.
Right. $5,000. There's just so many.
Let's go to Don. Don, what do you want to brag about, Don?
Yes. I've got a original photograph of my family member of the Cardinals football team, and it says Champions of Illinois, 1902.
Okay.
Wow.
Okay, we'll work with that.
1902 Chicago Cardinals. Now, a younger generation's going, what? Cardinals Chicago? That doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they had the original franchise for Chicago with the NFL later.
That's right.
Right.
There you go. I was just setting you up for a history lesson there, Don.
Right. 1902. Wow, I can't find 1902.
That's great, though. I would assume that's a huge deal, the 1902 Chicago Cardinals autograph. That's awesome. I'm surprised.
Yeah, it should be, but I can't find anything to compare it to. But
that's
good item.
That's good. I like that one.
That
it's in the lead for the best brag, Don. You might get a pizza out of this.
Hey, that's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah, nothing wrong with that. Long way to go, though. Thanks, Don.
Thanks.
Thank you. Good night.
All right, good night. Let's keep going. Let's go to Scott. Scott, what do you want to brag about? Scott, what do you got?
Hey, here's what I got. I came across an old picture. My dad took me a long time ago to the auto show in the 70s. I think it's Walter Payton's rookie year. He is standing in front of an old 76-77 Buick Regal, the front of it, at Soldier Field, in a nice three-piece suit with the vest and all that.
Nice.
And on the back is all the Buick dealers from the 70s there.
Wow.
So it's an official thing. And on the front, it's signed Walter Payton. I hope I beat O.J. Simpson.
No!
Wow.
Yay! Yes! Yes!
Wow.
Wow.
Oddly, there's quite a few of them, and he's in front of different cars. I see offhand just like four different cars that he's standing in front of, and they're ranging from $10 to $250.
But what about would you throw the OJ? Would that kitsch factor?
Yeah.
Would that
history I think that would matter.
Really?
And I think that would bump it up a few, maybe another $40 or $50 because of that.
Scott,
nice.
You're in the lead, man. You're in the lead for the pizza too. You just took over from the 1902
Cardinals. But there are some signed that you know that are just $25. So hopefully your OJ factor would bump it up quite a bit.
Wow.
Better than a stick in the eye. I'll there's take a great, 25 and the pizza.
Nice. I just saw a meme. A friend of mine put up a piece on a picture on Instagram, and it was a black and white photo of Ahmad Rashad's wedding.
Okay.
To Felicia Rashad, and his groomsmen were on the right side was O.J. Simpson, on the left side was Bill Cosby.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my.
That's, I think the 1,000 there. Like, you might want to pick your wedding party.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah, there you
go. Thanks, Scott.
Well,
thanks, guys.
Good luck.
All right. There you go. All right. Let's keep going. Let's go to Stacy. Stacy, what do you want to brag about, Stacy?
Oh, I have one of the original Barbie dolls from the 60s.
Nice.
The blonde bubble cut, gorgeous clothes, still probably gorgeous, and the original 10.
Okay.
And beautiful clothes.
And
I'm looking to see how much this could be worth because, you know, it's from the early 60s.
Right. Yeah, well, you're in the ballpark because I guess the Holy Grail was the 1962 Barbie.
Right.
And those have gone for thousands, like $4,000 or $5,000, $6,000. So you need to find out what year it is for sure. I mean, not tonight, but, you know, in your research. And you don't have the box, though, right? You've got the accessories, but no box, right?
Oh, no, I have the original box.
Okay, great.
Wow.
That she came in, and I have a whole bunch of accessories.
Great.
And then my husband's not here, but I know he was a big Star Trek fan.
Okay.
And he has a whole bunch of Star Trek stuff. And what about, like, Don Ho? I have a picture with him from 1978 signed.
Yeah, I had Don Ho stuff, and I can't do anything with it.
Did you go visit like Hawaii, and he was performing, or how'd you get the autograph?
Right. He was performing, and a bunch of us. They pulled us backstage, and he just, we sat on his lap, and
Santa Claus.
He took a picture.
Hawaiian Santa Claus. Nice.
That's great.
You got some great stuff, the early right. Barbie stuff, and then the earlier with Star Trek, the better. Obviously, as we got into the 80s, they just made so much of it that not much is worth anything.
What about, albums or VHS? Because we have the small 45s, a whole bunch from, oh, gosh.
Of various artists, or were you talking Star Trek, or what are you talking with the 45s?
Oh, records.
Okay, yeah. Obviously, in general, jazz does really well, and rock and pop does well. If you have easy listening or classical, you really have a niche customer that you're looking for at that. But if you have a little bit of everything, yeah, have it checked out.
There you go. Thanks, Stacey.
What about the... I think we have 78 from my parents.
Yeah, that's very specific. Yeah, you got to research each one. Some are going to be worth nothing, and you might have a needle in the haystack with the 78s, especially jazz.
All right. Thanks, Stacey. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Should I hold on? Or?
Yeah, you can hold on.
Yep.
All right. Well, we'll just pass it off to Pete. You can take care of it at that point. That's some interesting stuff. And yeah. Don Ho, I think he died, right? He died.
I'm not sure.
Friends of mine went and they did their honeymoon in Hawaii. This was probably about 10 years ago. And they saw Don Ho perform. And their description of it, because at that point he was probably in his 80s or 90s, was phone in city.
Oh, yeah.
He had a routine down. When he needed to sing his Tiny Bubbles or whatever it was. And the rest, he just kind of just sat at a desk.
Yeah.
I would much rather see Don Ho in that form, like the checked out 90-year-old Don Ho show. That would be worth it. You got stuff from that era. It's probably worth something.
Yeah, obviously, I'm a child of the 60s, 70s. I only remember Tiny Bubbles. I could not name you another song.
Yeah, Don Ho. That's exactly it. It's 262 said the last woman, she sounded like she was planning a garage sale.
Yeah.
That's good. Oh, we've got Al on the line, Peter, Bob, people on the text, 312-981-7200. Let's get into it. Second half of the Swap Meet coming up here right after the news. Stay with us.
It's time for Swap Meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman
and Greg Flam.
Second half.
That's right, the second half of the Swap Meet at Two-Page Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. Of course, our segment we do every Wednesday night where we evaluate your collectibles, your memorabilia, your junk. 312-981-7200. Also giving away a pizza to the best brag tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, the Walter Payton saying, I hope I beat OJ picture at the car show.
That is pretty cool.
Standing in front of the new Ford Escort or whatever he's standing in front. That's so good.
Yep.
All right, let's keep going. Let's go to Al. Al, what do you want to brag about?
Hi, I have a from a Reading Basil series from about the 1950s. It was the typical Dick and Jane
series. Oh, yeah, right.
Those characters. And I have in the original packing box about 12 3 feet by 2 feet cardstock. They're kind of like teaching charts.
Sure.
So they have a big graphic of Dick and Jane and all the characters. There's about 12 of them. And they may have like a few sight words on them or like a simple sentence.
Sure.
And they've never been touched.
Wow.
ever. So I have them stored away, and I'm just wondering, you know, is something like that, you know, do people look for things like that? I kept thinking that perhaps maybe I would get them framed, or a few of them framed, because I just think
they're
pretty cool.
I mean, they're obviously cool. Everyone knows those images, and they're iconic. Do they still use those things? Like, does Dick and Jane books, are they?
No, they don't even use Basil readers anymore.
Yeah, there are some online I found.
How about Highlights magazine? Is that still a thing? No?
Oh, they're still around.
Okay, good.
They're just digital. Not going for that much, though. They're like $10 a piece. You know, is what you probably can expect, or maybe even two for $10 is what I'm finding. The cutouts are a little bit more than that, but I'm surprised they're as low as they are. So, but they are kind of common, though.
I do like them, though.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty good one. I like this one.
Yeah. See, I've never seen them in schools anywhere, and I happen to find them in a closet. Like, I thought it was actually the bottom of a shelf.
Yeah, someone will want them, so definitely hold on to them, or you know, try to find a good someone who will pay for them.
So, okay, thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Al. All right, bye bye. Peter's got one. Peter, what do you want to brag about, Peter?
Well, I've got three things and a short story. I've got a blank check with two Bobby Hull signatures on it. The first one, my wife jumped in his arms at Ditka's first restaurant when he was coaching the Bears.
All right.
And then the second one I got down in Florida, my future son-in-law went to a card show and got another one, and he about flipped out when he saw the first one.
Wow.
I'm just kind of confused. What do you mean? You have blank checks with Bobby Hull's signature? What is that? What do you mean?
My wife saw Bobby walk into Ditka's.
Okay.
Jumped up, ran up to him and Gary Matthews, and literally jumped in his arms.
Okay.
When I went up there to retrieve her, she ran back to the table, grabbed her checkbook, ripped the check out, and got a signature on the check.
Well, is it in the spot where you're supposed to get the where you're supposed to sign the check? No, sign the whole check, right?
It's right across diagonally, both of them.
Okay, like at least we clarified that because I was hoping it was Bobby Hull's check. That would have made a huge difference.
He's just like, thanks for jumping into my arms. Here's a blank check.
Right.
Yep.
Have some fun today on Michigan Avenue, guys.
I've got
two worker hats, one black velvet and one red velvet from the Columbia Space Shuttle.
Wow.
Those are pretty important to me. And then the third thing I've got is an autographed picture of Dale Earnhardt's silver number 3 car with him in street clothes standing next to it on a track. And the story I have is we were at the old stadium at the back door waiting for Michael Jordan, me and my daughter. We were the first car in the parking lot, so she got everybody's autograph as everybody came in. Johnny Red Kerr, everybody on her coat.
Okay.
When Michael finally showed up, we started walking towards his red Testarossa. He gets out of the car. I told my daughter, wait till he gets his bag out of the truck. Well, there's no trunk on a Testarossa. He grabs the bag, starts walking. I said, Michael. He turned around, looked at my daughter, and he goes, your name's Kelly, isn't it?
What?
So the story is that he knew my daughter before he ever met her because of the other players. My other daughter's boyfriend was a friend of Stacey King's, and all the other players knew about my daughter. He walked us to our seat, gave her a pass to shoot a free throw at halftime.
Wow.
Stuck his tongue out, gave her a thumbs up through the whole game.
Oh, man.
We were in the seventh row right behind the Bulls bench.
That's awesome.
That's amazing.
That's a great story.
It's a total Chicago story. Wow. Peter, you're in the lead. So, I might have to give you a pizza now just for that.
Well, those are true stories, and I can prove it because she's got all the signatures. And she's got quite a collection, too.
That's great stuff.
Appreciate it, Peter. Thank you.
I don't even know where to begin.
Well, let's just get Peter's number and see if he wants to party. I think that's
right.
Seems to know where to be. I love that's such that's a great Chicago story.
Right.
I think he named every athlete of record in the 80s in that conversation.
In Chicago, right? Yeah.
I mean, we walked up and he's hanging out with Bobby Gary
Hall,
Matthews.
Stacey King.
Let's go to Bob. Bob, top that. Bob, what do you want to brag about?
Okay. I was at a fundraiser and I bought a picture that was autographed. It's one picture. It's Michael Jordan, Andre Dawson, and Walter Payton, all in tuxedo.
Yes, I love that one.
Yeah, that's a classic poster. Yeah. You say it's like an 8x10 picture of what you have, though? Or do you have a poster of it?
It's the poster version. Yeah.
Okay.
And
that one we've get a couple times on the show. There used to be the poster version was in a storefront on Madison near my house, and I'd walk by, and it was just like on display, and I was always like, well, that's a cool thing to have on display.
Yep, and the fact that you got all three signed, that's pretty cool.
That's a try. How long did that take you to get?
I bought it that way.
Oh, you bought it that way. Right. Got it. I'm sorry. That's right.
It was at a fundraiser. Right, it was for like Mercy Home for Boys.
I would give you the pizza if you said 14 years and I had to track down everybody. Then I'd be like, oh my God, buying it as a fundraiser, you lose a little points.
If you said I won the pizza, I wouldn't take it because I'm the guy that has Ross Binkowski's cup.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Which, you know, I was telling Greg, I saw a picture of somebody who was at Ross Binkowski's estate sale
right.
last week or 2 weeks ago. Yeah, he had an estate sale.
Yeah, it was listed online.
Those were given to me personally. I will never part with those. But yeah, it was a fundraiser for Mercy Home for Boys.
Okay, just to give you an idea, the poster itself, not signed, is about $50 to $100. That poster, and then you had the signatures on there, and that I would have it authenticated. You know, get it graded because you could be in the more than $1,000-$1,500 range for something like that with those three signatures. Yeah. To have all three signatures on that. I mean, if you only had one signature, then you're looking at whatever, 150, 180. But to have all three, that's awesome.
That's awesome. Way to go, Bob.
Awesome, Dawson.
You know how to play this game. Awesome.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for calling.
Did you see the story today I saw in CBS Sports, which was it's like all news now. It's from somewhere else. I think it was the USA Today. That Andre Dawson has been running a funeral home.
Haven't heard that.
I don't know if it's in Chicago where it's at, but he's been running a funeral home for more than a decade.
Wow.
I mean, he's obviously an ambassador for the Cubs organization. We've seen him. He's been on WGN. But I had no idea. This article in USA Today came out about this, and you're like, well, I didn't know that. Maybe it has been referenced in different points, but I just didn't know. Wow. Greg Flamm is here. It's the Swap Meet, 312-981-7200. We got Peter. We've got Rich. I got some great texts to get to. You still can get in and steal the pizza if you got a good story. 312-981-7200. We'll take our last break. Stay with us. All right, Greg Flamm is here. It's a swap meet, 312-981-7200. We're playing for pizza tonight. Also, you can find out what something valuable to you is worth. Mm-hmm. Let's go to Rich. Rich, what do you want to brag about, Rich?
I got a concert shirt for the Who from 1982.
Yeah. Awesome.
It's never been worn, never been laundered, and nothing signed or anything like that.
Did you buy it and then say, I'm just going to keep this, or where'd you get it?
Yes.
That's awesome.
Really? No way. That's discipline. I'd have that. I'd be already, they'd be all pitted out. Like if it were me, no good.
I just had a lot of other things to wear. I just respected it and just kept it.
You had your cutoff jacket.
I also, from 82 or 83, I also have a Marshall Tucker concert shirt.
Okay. The Who one, is it white with red, what they call a ringer? This is a black one. Okay.
Black sleeves.
Yeah, give me a moment. But I did find, on the same subject, I did find a 1980 Who tour program this past week as well. It's only worth about $25, but I'm looking for your shirt right now.
All right. I like that, though.
But yeah, I think you're in the 100 to 150 range is what I'm thinking, but I will verify
1982.
That.
1982.
Yeah.
Are you hanging out? You ever seen the film Heavy Metal Parking Lot? You ever seen that one, Rich? You should go see that movie. It's about a bunch of guys.
I'm
going
to go see it. But I have a quick story for you if you want. You know, sorry. My old man had a cup of coffee with the White Sox. And for the 50th All-Star anniversary. It was 83 or 84 at Comiskey Park. Yeah, the Sox were playing the Yankees, and I have pictures with Yogi Berra and Luke Appling on the field, and we were up in the suite, and I was 16 years old. My brother was 22. He was mixing me gin and tonics, and you know, Don Drysdale was there. I don't know what he was doing there or why, but it was like shortly after he had, if you remember, he got mugged in California.
Wow.
And lost one of his rings.
Okay, that, I briefly remember that part, yeah.
Do you remember something like that?
The ring part, I remember, yeah.
Yeah, but it was like right after that had happened, and it was just like, you know, like nothing had ever wow. happened. And I was 16, and then I was there.
Well, wasn't that he was friends with Hawk Harrelson, and he was around during the 80s, so that might have been why he was hanging out there.
There was a connection there.
Yeah.
But there was a cast of characters there, but
no,
you know,
it's great that you got to see that.
I slowly forgot where I was at due to my brother. Thanks a lot.
Well, thanks. All right, cool. Thanks, Rich. Appreciate it,
okay,
man.
Okay, man.
All right, thanks.
That's good stuff. I like that. Danny, what do you want to brag about, Danny? We're getting into rapid fire. What do you need?
Okay, so real quick, I just want to tell you a Brian Urlacher story. I have a game-worn Urlacher jersey signature, game-worn in the playoffs.
Wow.
But that's not – if it just real quick, I just want to tell you the story. So I run a restaurant in Northbrook, and it's a hibachi restaurant. And this guy – it was 5 minutes to nine. We're closing, and this guy pulls up. And my host says, Danny, there's someone that's coming in. And I said, well, we're closed. And he goes, well, can you tell him? Because he's kind of big. And I said, all right. So I go up in front. And it's and I didn't recognize him because you never see the football players without their helmets.
He doesn't look so like, he's not as big as you think he is.
I swear he doesn't look like that.
No, he doesn't,
So he walks up to me and goes, hey, look, is there any way I can get some food? And I said, well, we're closed. And he goes, is there any way? And he kind of looked, he was kind of startled when I said no. And I said, I'll tell you what, if you wait, you know, what do you need? He goes, well, if you can give me, you know, a couple ribeyes. And I said, okay, sure, no problem. What temperature?
To go. Oh,
medium. To go, right? So I said, okay, so he's waiting, and I'm looking at him, and I'm going, this guy is somebody. I don't know who this guy is.
Wow.
He's on his cell phone, and he's sitting down, and he's in flip-flops.
Right.
He's in shorts and a dago, and I'm like, this guy has no...
Yeah.
And, you know, he tipped the bill, which is outstanding. I was like, and I'm like, are you sure you want to leave that
knows,
much money?
Right.
He goes, yeah,
absolutely.
He's a class act. So all of a sudden, he's leaving, and he goes, hey, by the way, are you a Bears fan? As soon as he said that, I go, oh, God, I'm so sorry.
Ronnie Gold.
He's like, don't worry about it. And sure enough, literally a week and a half later, he sends me a game-worn jersey. I mean, what a class act.
That is good. That's a good
little
story.
I was going to say, when was this? Was he playing for the Bears at the time?
Yeah, he was playing for the Bears at the time, and, you know, he was in unbelievable shape, and I just didn't recognize him.
Yeah.
He followed, I mean... But when you see a guy that big, when someone comes in my restaurant,
I
look at him, I go, this guy's pretty big. Like,
yeah.
Who is this guy?
He wishes now he wants those jerseys back because he thought there would be a string of playoff games, and it didn't.
And obviously it's too soon, and he signed a lot, so they're like 75 to 150 as far as what your value of your jersey
still,
is.
Awesome
but that's
story.
A great story, yeah, and it's awesome you got to experience
it. Yeah,
that.
I'll never sell it.
Yeah,
he's a class act. So
that's awesome.
It's staying in my office.
Thanks, Danny.
Cool.
Appreciate
Thanks
it.
Thanks for calling.
All right, that's going to do it for the swap meet. Sorry I didn't get to Al or to Alan. We still have our mystery.
We'll just say.
Let me get one more shot
right.
on it. It is a bobblehead of Steve Cochran.
No.
It
is like a steel heavy pen set, like baseball.
Oh, wow.
With a pen that it fits in.
Yeah, like so. At the bank.
Yeah, but like, you know, heavy duty. Like,
oh, that's cool.
Yeah, baseball bat pen.
A baseball bat.
So now
pen.
You have that for
didn't
your
get, I didn't
new
get anywhere
desk
near
at 303
that.
Wacker.
Yeah. Oh, that's nice. Yay. All
it
right.
doesn't say Cubs. It just says WGN 720.
All right. We got a Lou Malnati's gift card to give away tonight.
Yep.
Of course, visit any of the 40-plus locations of Lou Malnati's around the city. Great pizza in the city of Chicago. Mm-hmm. The winner tonight, I got to give it to Peter. Peter, of course, telling stories about how his wife jumped into the arms of Bobby Hull. He signed a couple of checks. also, the story of Michael Jordan and the car that he had.
In the Bulls.
Peter gets the just for that. There was some good stuff tonight. And I appreciate everybody calling in. Greg Flamm at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter.
Yes.
So you can get there and find out any information, talk to him, do the whole bit, and he will be back next week, next Wednesday. Greg Flamm, great to see you, buddy.
Great, thanks.